On the 27th of January, 1931, this room was laid out for a livery dinner. As was common at the time, the top table was along that wall. The master was sitting in the centre of the top table, and he was accompanied by 127 liverymen and their guests. The clerk's records show that there were some extremely distinguished people there that night. Headed by the Lord Mayor and the two sheriffs of the City of London, distinguished surgeons, physicians, and the Secretary of the Medical Research Council, who was a liveryman. Seated to the master's right were guests that included the President of the British Medical Association, the President of the Royal Society, President of the Royal Academy, the Earl Russell, and the Lord Mayor. Seated on the master's left were two distinguished surgeons, Sir John Lynn Thomas and Lord Moynihan. And between them was Dr. Henry Wellcome, pharmaceutical manufacturer and philanthropist. Henry Wellcome's presence there can be explained in the minutes of the private court, in which it is explained in the third paragraph down that Henry Wellcome, the clerk, is directed to invite and Dr. Wellcome to suggest whether he would like to attend a livery dinner to receive the honour of freedom of this society. He was actually invited to a livery dinner in April, but was unable to attend as he was in America, thus he arrived at the January livery dinner. And in the Wellcome archives is Henry Wellcome's reply to the master, Colonel Salmon, whose portrait is in the courtroom, parlour, in the parlour, when you have a drink after the lecture. Henry Wellcome wrote how very gratified he was to have been given this great honour by the Society of Apothecaries, because he had been associated with apothecarial pharmaceutical matters for all his career, and it gave him a great deal of pleasure and honour. He says, I have always been greatly interested in the history of your ancient guild and mystery. And in my historical medical museum, I have endeavoured to show the important part the Society of Apothecaries has taken in the history of English medicine. They, however, were not the only intriguing, unusual guests that evening, because sitting opposite the master was representative of the Times, and it is to that unnamed gentleman that we owe an account that appeared the following morning in the Times about the meeting here at the dinner at Apothecaries Hall. It explains about Henry Wellcome receiving the honorary freedom of the society, that he was presented to the master by Walter Dixon, the noted pharmacologist, who talked about Henry Wellcome's work in medicine and as a social benefactor, and in particular work he had done in the tropics, in Egypt and in Sudan, and throughout the world. How well known he was for his work in bacteriological research and in providing motorized laboratories. This is a copy. This is a picture of the original of Henry Wellcome's freedom certificate. It is absolutely exquisite. It's in the Wellcome archives, in the Wellcome library. It is hand-painted, and it is absolutely beautiful. It's no wonder that Henry Wellcome was not only delighted by the honour, but by the beauty of the object that he received. However, Henry Wellcome had to wait disgracefully long for such honours. He was 77 when the Society of Apothecaries honoured him. And this picture of Henry Wellcome is contemporaneous. This is not a picture of him here in this hall, but at another dinner the same year. However, the Society of Apothecaries was ahead of the nation, who Henry Wellcome was awarded a knighthood in the New Year's Honours in 1932. And that same year, he was elected a Fellow of the Royal Society. So, who was Henry Wellcome? I'm sure the name is familiar to all of you, and you all know something about Welcome and something about the organisations to which his name is now attached. The Welcome Trust, the Welcome Library, Welcome Collection. But who was Welcome the man? Well, he was born in Garden City, Minnesota. He grew up there. This was genuinely Indian country. If you can see the top picture there, this is a farmhouse near where his parents lived. And this was attacked by Indians and the inhabitants murdered when Welcome was 8. And indeed, one of the first things he remembers collecting as a child were the heads of arrows, Indian arrowheads. His father, who is shown immediately below that picture, was a general storekeeper in Garden City, Minnesota. You can see he had a very clear eye for publicity. Looking at the newspaper on the left, his advert is about Indians and Indians being on the warpath and protecting your family by buying in drugs, by buying in medicines and foodstuffs before the Indians take over. But Henry Welcome's uncle, who is pictured on the bottom, was actually a physician and surgeon who had trained with the Mayo brothers before they started the Mayo Clinic. And on the right is another picture, another section of the Garden City Courier, which has adverts from both Henry Welcome's father for the general drugstore and grocers, and the Dr. Jacob Welcome, physician and surgeon. So to some extent, Henry Welcome was already primed towards a career in pharmacy or in medicine. This is one of the earliest pictures of Henry Welcome. He was then 16. He showed early signs of entrepreneurship himself. Here he had, this is an advert, because he had then prepared a secret magic ink, i.e. invisible ink, a lemon juice preparation that showed up only when you held it to the light. And he was marketing this, or trying to market it, when he was 16. And he'd moved to Chicago with the aim of studying at the School of Pharmacy there. In the event he was unable to complete his studies in Chicago because the School of Pharmacy burned down. And he had to transfer to Philadelphia, where in 1874 he graduated with a degree in pharmacy. Certificate based largely on his classwork, his experimental work, scientific analytical work, very similar to some extent to the kind of exams that were being held in this hall for apothecaries and also for dispensing assistants. And Henry Welcome was determined throughout his career to actually go that bit step further. So very early on, and the publication below is actually from 1876, Henry Welcome started collecting materials, trying to analyze them, and to publish them. Most unusual for a young man at that time. He became a pharmaceutical salesman. He joined big companies, and for a long time he was with an American company, McKesson and Robbins. And he traveled particularly through North America and South America, looking for supplies of drugs, particularly cinchona and quinine. And this picture at the top on the left is of Henry Welcome in Ecuador in 1878. Henry Welcome is on the left, and on the back of this card, as he writes, "It feels like I am on the hurricane deck of a mule." But what he did on these trips was he was always looking for artifacts. He wasn't just looking for botanical and herbal remedies. He was looking for broader cultural medicines, foodstuffs, clothes, instruments. Already he had a very inquiring mind, and he was a collector. He also, practically everywhere he went, had his photograph taken. Here is one taken in Peru, in Lima. And this is a very interesting record of as he was traveling, where he had been, and how he saw himself and presented himself. This is 1879, this picture on the right. In 1880, he was invited by a fellow American pharmacist, Silas Burroughs, to come to London. Silas Burroughs is on the right. The picture of Henry Welcome on the left is a little later than 1880, so these two are not contemporaneous. Burroughs had been here for some time and thought that there were a lot of opportunities for young go-ahead pharmacists in Britain. London was of particular importance because it was a major port. It was the capital of a global empire. They had access through London to markets around the world. And also there was the continent not far away, and they had contacts and networks in America that they could exploit. They could really start an international company by moving to London. Wellcome was intrigued enough to say yes, and he arrived in London in September 1880, and the two men started a partnership which blossomed beautifully to begin with and soured. They sued each other to dissolve the partnership in 1884, and again in 1895. They were in the law courts or about to go to law when Silas Burroughs died. He died of pneumonia in the south of France, and Henry Wellcome thus inherited the entire company that they were beginning to build up as an international imperial organisation. That company was really a go-getting, far-ahead organisation. It had company headquarters, which are shown on the top left there. That is on the corner of High Holborn and Snow Hill, so not very far from here, very much in the pharmacy area. That building survived until 1942 when it was bombed and was never replaced. That was the first building in the City of London to be entirely lit by electric light, which shows something of this young, dynamic company and how they wanted to really embrace modern science and modern scientific methods. They set up their own production factory initially, which the picture on the top right is of, initially in Wandsworth. And if you look carefully at that, you'll see it says factory and laboratories. Now, to us, laboratories, research and development is a key part of the pharmaceutical industry. We understand the pharmaceutical industry as a research-led industry. This was not the way in the 1880s. And Burroughs Wellcome really, really forced the pace on that. And especially after Burroughs died and Wellcome had complete control, a number of laboratories were developed within the company, standardization and production labs, but also external to the company. And we have the Wellcome Tropical Labs, the Wellcome Chemical Labs, the Wellcome Physiological Labs, which became part, ultimately, of the R&D part of the Wellcome Foundation. And it is from the Wellcome Physiological Labs in this country and in America that five Nobel laureates have appeared. The bottom left-hand corner shows a picture in the Wellcome Physiological Research Laboratory in 1906. And the man in the middle, with his back to the camera, is the later Sir Henry Dale, Nobel laureate, employed by Henry Wellcome from 1904. Henry Wellcome had a very keen eye for sharp young men. And Burroughs Wellcome pioneered modern production standards and record keeping throughout their factory and their laboratories. Henry Wellcome also inherited by having the whole of Burroughs Wellcome, he inherited some extremely good brands such as Kepler cod liver oil, and Kepler cod liver oil and malt extract really made a lot of money for Burroughs Wellcome right up until the 1940s. But Henry Wellcome had a very, very keen eye for marketing. You can see that lovely advert with the fish and the malt and the wheat, malt extract. On the far right is a cartoon from 1904 from Chemist and Druggist, showing Henry Wellcome with these symbols. He was so associated with marketing, with symbols, and with one particular word, which he coined tabloid. And that was defended until Henry Wellcome's death. Nobody dared use the word tabloid the way we use the word tabloid, because it was a registered trade name of Burroughs Wellcome. And Henry Wellcome did something very, very, very unusual in this country. He started employing what in America are called detail men. In this country, we would now call them drug reps. And on the picture at the bottom right, this is the first cohort of men trained by Burroughs Wellcome to go out to talk to chemists, to talk to druggists, and to go and talk to doctors about their preparations. These men, this is their first annual conference. They were constantly trained. They were constantly kept in touch with latest developments. And because of the late 19th century was a period of medical unemployment, quite a few of these men were actually medically qualified. So they were a very good bridge between the pharmaceutical company and the medical and chemical professions. Henry Wellcome was extremely interested in displays, in communicating what his company was doing to the wider world, usually chemists and druggists and doctors, but often sometimes also to local groups, school groups or women's institutes. He would provide a speaker or a display. This is the Chicago 1893 World Fair. This is a Burroughs Wellcome stand. They won a gold medal there, and Henry Wellcome was there at the time. Now, part of those displays is hard for you to see, but they're not just drug bottles, but all sorts of other artifacts, equipment, recipe books. There's a lot going on in that case, because Henry Wellcome was not just interested in pharmacy or medicine. He was a collector. He was a pathological collector almost. He collected books, manuscripts, artifacts, anything to do with medicine, very, very broadly defined. In fact, when he moved to London in 1880, there was very interesting correspondence in his own personal letters about transferring, actually getting his books and equipment collection transferred from Philadelphia to London. And I'm not sure that Henry Wellcome ever drew clear lines between pharmacy, history, medicine, archaeology. To him, they were all very much of a muchness. His collecting became very, very serious, particularly in the 20th century. But this is a catalogue of books and manuscripts of William Morris. This is 1898. And in the Wellcome archives is Henry Wellcome's own copy of the catalogue, marked up. And you can see that there are prices he's prepared to go for. He is not going to go and bid himself, because already he is getting notorious, and people see him coming. So he's already developing agents to go and buy for him. And you'll see he's marked it up with the prices. But if you look carefully at the side, there are annotations. In the bottom left-hand side, for example, it actually talks about numerous quaint coloured borders, effective for decoration. And the annotation above that says, glorious illustrations for show cards. He was looking at some of this historical material as a source of illustrations and information for his medical adverts and his medical work. And these adverts, one from the Lancet, one from the British Medical Journal, show this exactly. These are from a slightly later period, but if you look at the one from the Lancet on the left, this is from January 1920 for sera and vaccines. And you look at the top, it says pioneers and empire builders, first period, number 4. And at the bottom, there's a little bit of text and some illustrations about Pithecanthropus. The advert on the right from the British Medical Journal, from about 9 years later, now we are onto Pioneers and Empire Builders, number 524. And here we have an example of an ancient temple from India with a nice line drawing. And all of these materials, so there are vast quantities of these adverts and in the Wellcome archives, all the guard books, the original drawings for these were all taken from the books and manuscripts and material that Henry Wellcome acquired during his collecting activities. Indeed, for many years, all his books and the library went to the company and were part of what was originally called the propaganda department, later becoming known as the sales and marketing department. Henry Welcome became a wealthy man as the sole owner of Bowes Welcome, and he travelled extensively. He particularly liked Egypt and Anglo-Egypt, the Sudan. And in 1901, this is a picture of him on a ship going down the Nile. In 1901, he met re-met a young lady who he'd known briefly. Her name was Gwendolyn Surrey Barnardo. She was Dr. Barnardo's daughter. And Welcome and the Barnardos had been neighbours for two or three years in Surbiton. Now, for a historian, it's actually very nice when principals, people you're interested in, are away, because they then write letters home. When Henry Welcome was in the office directing things, it's very difficult to find out what he was doing every day. When he's away, he's writing letters, often 20, 30-page letters a day to the company, describing what he wants to do in the lab, in the factory, the library materials. Very, very detailed, wonderful sources for historians. Not so wonderful to read. I speak with some authority on this. I have actually turned the pages, although I have not actually read every page, 40,000 pages of Henry Welcome's letters. Not all of them are like this. This fantastic once a typewriter has been utilised. But this is a letter from Welcome to the company. I think this is 1898. And you can see the condition it's in. And this is quite a good one, because I could actually have this one photographed. But it's very difficult to read down. The ink spreads through these letter books, 1,000 letters in each letter book. The ink spreads laterally and vertically. So you are really dealing with sort of 2D chromatography. And sometimes the only way to read these is through the back, using something like an orange filter to actually try to work out what the letters are. And you have to read quite a bit of a letter to know that you don't have to read that letter. So it is really quite frustrating and laborious. However, let me go back. 1901, Henry Welcome, writing letters home, writing letters to Bowes Welcome, and meeting Gwendolyn Surrey Barnardo on the Nile. Surrey and Henry decide to get married. There is a 26-year age difference. Unfortunately, Dr. Barnardo is a little unwell. He dies shortly after. And so there's a very quiet wedding, no reception, no honeymoon. And accounts actually say, contemporary accounts do actually talk of the couple really being very much in love. Although this wedding picture must be one of the most bizarre wedding pictures I have ever seen. As they had a son, Montenay, in 1903, but Henry Welcome continued to travel. This is a picture in 1908. He took his wife and son with him. And Surrey got to the stage where she wrote to her friend, "I detest this travelling and collecting curios." And she just did see Henry Welcome as a rich man indulging some silly hobby, where for Henry Welcome already, he was trying to get a collection that told the history of mankind, the history of man, the science of man. Travelling was probably not the only problem in their relationship, but it certainly came to be the major problem in their relationship. And in 1910, Surrey walked out on Welcome, caused a tremendous scandal. And in 1915, she gave birth to a daughter, fathered by Somerset Maugham. And at that point, Henry Welcome had to take legal action, divorced her, and got custody of the son. Although he was the innocent party, one can well see that the stigma of divorce at that time may well have accounted for the long delay he had in getting the honours due to him. After Surrey's departure, he spent more and more time abroad, and in particular in the Sudan. Now, this is a picture taken in 1913 at an archaeological site on the Nile called Jebel Moya, that Henry Welcome discovered, and he employed hundreds of Sudanese workers to come and excavate. In fact, for many years, he was the single largest employer of people in the Sudan, all excavating his archaeological site. Welcome was very interested in photography, so he devised with some of his colleagues a system of taking aerial photographs using balloons and pulleys so that they could actually photograph the site from above. And several times he actually visited the site himself. Here he is in the white tropical suit and tupi. This is 1913. And these pictures are also taken from 1913. You can see Henry Welcome at the top. In the bottom, here's a man on the far left sitting in the chair. It's thus unusual, for that's the only picture I know from Jebel Moya where he's not wearing that tropical hat. And on the right, there he is, exploring, or just looking down over the entire excavation site. And in the Welcome archives, there is a film of this. Here we see exactly the same site. This is the Jebel Moya site. Henry Welcome's diaries say that he recalls seeing a native village of thatched beehive hills with about 800 people living there and several nomadic tribes camped nearby. They employed, you can see the women and children employed there. It does go on. There is a picture of Henry Welcome. He is just sitting down. So a picture of Henry Welcome sitting down is a picture of Henry Welcome sitting down. But what did he do with all of these treasures? What did he do with all of this massive material he was accumulating? Well, he created a museum. This is the first museum he created. This is Wigmore Street, not very far from the present site of the Royal Society of Medicine. And this became known as the Welcome Welcome Museum for History of Medicine. The site was acquired in 1911. Henry Welcome employed professional curators and historians to try to make sense of this massive material that was arriving almost every week in the London docks. A crate would arrive. And he was persuaded by his curator to open it for the 1913 World Medical Conference arriving in London. It was arranged in both a chronological and a thematic scheme. So there's history of tropical medicine throughout the ages, history of anatomy throughout the ages. This is just part of the plan showing the entrance on Wigmore Street. The museum then developed into rather an L-shaped organization. For the International Medical Congress, a booklet was provided which shows more details of all of the different parts of the museum, some detailed explanations of all the artifacts he had there. And it's quite beautifully illustrated at the time. But to a modern eye, that just looks quite a mess. That is the Hall of Statuary, and things are in there because they are statues. That is sometimes quite difficult for a modern audience to look at that and see what sense he's trying to make from it. But it was enormously popular. The participants at the International Medical Congress enjoyed going there. Henry Welcome's curators suggested that it should be open more widely to the public. Henry Welcome insisted that it was a place for study and research. He also started accumulating all his books that had been out in the company. All the books were coming into here, and he was going to have a library that people could use to research in, although that was not open until you'll see later, until 1946. But he insisted that the people who came to this museum were medical, and anybody could gain access as long as they had a visiting card showing their medical qualifications. They could gain access into his History of Medicine Museum. Most unusually, Henry Welcome he was a novice, he was a private person, he wasn't an organisation. He acquired a considerable reputation as a collector and a manager of museums. And in 1928, he was asked to provide evidence to the Royal Commission on National Museums and Archives. There he said, he spoke to them frankly, he said, "I've been gathering material all my life," which is probably pretty true, as he started as a boy of eight with the Indian arrowheads. At that time, and through the next 30 years, Henry Wellcome provided for his collections something like an expenditure that which was double that of the British Museum every year. And on his death, it was realised that he had acquired over five times as many objects as those held by the Louvre. That little place on Wigmore Street could not hold everything. And in fact, everywhere, the Snow Hill the Snow Hill headquarters, the labs, everywhere had Henry Wellcome's collections in. And warehouses were hired to house Henry Wellcome's collections. There was not time to even open the boxes and make it a cursory list, as the material was arriving around the world so quickly. Because not only Henry Wellcome himself, but of course, he was a pharmaceutical manufacturer. He had agents and subsidiaries and other manufacturing companies around the world, all of whom were trained, if they saw something unusual, to ride back to Snow Hill. And if Henry Wellcome liked the sound of it, they would acquire it and send it back to London. So he had an international network of material of people collecting material for him. He already owned some land on Gordon Street and Gower Place, and that land was extended, and a new building was proposed to house Henry Wellcome's collections. This, of course, is what we now know as the Wellcome Building, on Euston Road, and this is it being built about the same time as Henry Wellcome was coming here to get his honorary freedom. And if you look carefully at the bottom image, and you can see some of the hoardings around the building, again, this looks most unusual to modern eyes. This is a medical organization, and there are adverts there for Guinness, Watney's, Player's Cigarettes, and Gold Flake. Can't imagine that happening nowadays, of course. Now, Henry Wellcome had a cornerstone ceremony in November 31, so the end of the year in which he'd been here getting his honorary freedom in the beginning. And who did he ask to open it or to lay the cornerstone? And you can see the cornerstone quite clearly if you walk out of the Wellcome Building. It's on the corner of Gordon Street on the building. But he asked the president of the Royal College of Surgeons, Lord Moynihan, who he had been sat next to on the table along there in January 1931. There is a photograph of that ceremony, Henry Wellcome speaking. Unfortunately, I can't identify anybody else in this photograph, so if anybody here recognises anybody or would like to talk to me afterwards about it, please do, because I would really like to know more about who those people are in that photograph. And Henry Wellcome invited a correspondent from The Times to join them for the cornerstone ceremony, and The Times wrote up a lovely piece about the Wellcome Research Bureau, a Wellcome Research Institution, this wonderful new building. And, you know, they paid an enormous amount of attention. This is the man, you can see there's a man doing the E for the Wellcome Building, it's called the Wellcome Building. Here they are engraving the name at the top of the building. And this is it when it's nearly complete. It's instantly recognisable as still the building it is today, although now, of course, there is an extra story built on top. There are in the Wellcome Archives detailed floor plans of this building, and the next slide shows part of it, but I think it's so faint you probably can't see it. Basically, the fourth and fifth floors were going to be labs, but the rest of the building was set around two light wells in the middle with four big galleries, a north, south, east and west, except on the second floor. This is the second floor, and the east gallery is actually called the statuary hall, because this was going to replace that hall of statuary from the Wigmore Street Museum. And here we see it, just as it's completed, before anything is moved in. And that, I'm sure, is familiar to many. That room is familiar to many of you. Here it is as the Hall of Statuary in Henry Wellcome's research institution. But sadly, Henry Wellcome did not live long enough to really enjoy his building. He died in July 1936, and so one of the uses of the building was put to, this is now the auditorium, if you're familiar with the Wellcome building. It's now built up with racked seats, but it was a flat auditorium. And Henry Wellcome's coffin was there for 5 days, and all the employees of the company and the labs and the museums all filed past to pay their respects. Henry Wellcome left a will. This is just a modern transcription of that will. And what he did is he made some personal bequests, particularly to relatives and causes in America, but what he did was he bequeathed most of his resources, his company, all his businesses in Britain and abroad, all the subsidiary companies. He bequeathed all his laboratories, his museums. He had about 3-4 museums at that stage, and his library to a board of 5 trustees. One of their immediate tasks was to find out what on earth it was he had left. There were about 8 warehouses around London that were packed full of material. This is one of those warehouses. This is Enfield. And I think Enfield was still going strong in the 1990s when it was finally cleared. These are just some of the books in one warehouse in Enfield. Those books, the trustees of the Wellcome Trust decided, should be made more publicly available. And they moved them into that building on Euston Road. And they moved them into what had been the Hall of Statuary to make a library. And this is shortly after the Second World War. This is about 1946-47. So they created a library in the Hall of Statuary. And they made it open to the public. They created what we would call reader services and general facilities to help the ordinary public come and utilise some of these wonderful resources. That library has been through many, many transformations, and I'm sure many of you here in this room will be familiar. This is how the library looked after a major refurbishment at the end of the 1960s, and was really like that until about the 1990s, when again it underwent a slightly different refurbishment. And suddenly that ghastly carpet went. That carpet had been there since 1946, and it wasn't very nice. But another refurbishment, and it's still substantially, you can recognise that Hall of Statuary, that is the Wellcome Library. But what about all the objects that Wellcome had acquired? All those boxes and boxes of material. There were lots and lots of books, there were about 500,000 books, I think. What about all the objects? Nobody knew how many objects. There were just so many warehouses full of unopened crates. And this, we're going back to Enfield. So this is that one warehouse in Enfield. And these are just part of one of the bays, stacked with material. Here, there's already a process of triage that has already started, because some of the crates have at last been opened, so people can see what is in them. In the early 21st century, the Wellcome Governors, Wellcome Trust, decided to re-evaluate or repurpose almost the Wellcome Building. It is still called the Wellcome Building. You can still see the signs of the Wellcome Building on the top. It's now known as the Wellcome Collection. It continues to house Henry Wellcome's materials. Of those boxes and boxes and tons of material that was found in warehouses around the city, the trustees decided that these had to be dispersed. The Science Museum has a very good collection of Wellcome material, as does obviously the Wellcome Trust themselves, but otherwise most of the material has been dispersed to museums around the world. It is said there's not a museum in this country that does not somewhere have something that came from Henry Wellcome. So this building now has been repurposed, completely exhibitions and public engagement and libraries and archives, which is very much what Henry Wellcome himself intended. On the first floor, there is now, and as the Wellcome Building has reopened recently, there is an exhibition called Medicine Man. And here are some of Henry Wellcome's own collections, as Henry Wellcome collected them, displayed in a more modern, more, to us, probably more congenial way. But these are Henry Wellcome's own collections. And in many ways, opening up that building to be museum, to be exhibitions, does revert to the original intention of Henry Wellcome and to his early trustees. Now, these pictures are all of exhibitions that were held in the Wellcome building in the 1950s and 1960s. They weren't in any particular space. As you can see, these are just in the open public spaces, the open corridors of the Wellcome building. The top is an exhibition that ran for about a year, I think, on a history of tropical medicine. The one on the right is a history of pharmacy exhibition that was throughout the building, and that also ran for a year. And the bottom left, which again looks like strange to modernise, this was an exhibition on Joseph Lister. And this is practically everything that Henry Wellcome had ever acquired associated with Joseph Lister. The library, that whole space, continues to be a dynamic experiment almost. And parts of the library have changed again quite drastically recently. This is now the reading room. So the gallery at the top is still familiar, but downstairs it's no longer a formal part of the library. It is an interactive space with objects and books and all sorts of things, all sorts of ideas and places, different kinds of seating, areas where people can sit, talk, look at objects without feeling they are in a museum or an exhibition or a library. But although it's different, it's still the same. It is still recognisable, and it is, I suspect, very much what Henry Wellcome himself would have liked and enjoyed. So I've told you something about Henry Wellcome, his vision, what he collected, what he did. Not very much. I could talk for hours on Henry Wellcome. So I've just tried to give you a flavour, and I'm very happy to tell you more over a drink or over supper. But the question I started with, is he a Sloane of our times? So Hans Sloane, this is quite a nice image, which is on the Wellcome Images side, but of course you might like to look at our portrait, which is in the middle there Sir Hans Sloane. I do advise this, that is a very, very nice portrait of Sir Hans Sloane. Now, how do we assess whether Henry Wellcome could be a modern Hans Sloane? Do we have a checklist, you know, FRSE tick, knighthood tick? Or do we look at the broad visions and contributions of what they both made? If we think of Hans Sloane, well, I have to say, one of Hans Sloane's great contributions was bringing chocolate to this country. I do approve of that. And of course, really, what he's most famous for is the British Museum, is how his acquisitive nature and all the objects that he collected became the basis of the British Museum and the Natural History Museum. A great gift to this country. What about Henry Wellcome? Henry Wellcome didn't bring chocolate, I know that. But he did coin the word tabloid. I think that's quite an interesting achievement. But what did Henry Wellcome do? Well, Henry Wellcome's legacy is the Wellcome Trust. It's not just his collections, it's the Wellcome Trust. It is the support of medicine, support of medical research, and then the support of medical history of medicine, medical humanities. And those astonishing, amazing collections, parts of which are in the Wellcome Library, in the Wellcome Collection now, the Wellcome Library itself, which is such a jewel with wonderful treasures, and in the Science Museum. Nobody could do that nowadays, and Henry Wellcome actually managed to make these astonishing acquisitions from across the world, and he had the money to do it, of course. So I hope I've given you, Master, members of court, ladies and gentlemen, I hope I've given you some sense of who Henry Wellcome was and what he did. And I need to thank members of my team and members of several organisations who have provided me with material for this talk. And when I thank individuals, I am also thanking the organisations for which they come. And you will not be surprised to hear And my major thanks are to the Wellcome Trust, because they fund me and my team. Thank you.